Welcome to Unpacking Peanuts, the podcast where three cartoonists take an in-depth look at the greatest comic strip of all time, Peanuts by Charles M. Schulz.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. This is Unpacking Peanuts. Today we're looking at the second half of 1976. I'm your host for the proceedings. My name's Jimmy Gownley. I'm also a cartoonist. I did books like the Amelia Rule series, Seven Good Reasons Not to Grow Up, and The Dumbest Idea Ever. Joining me, as always, are my pals, co-hosts, and fellow cartoonists. He's a playwright and a composer, both for the band Complicated People as well as for this very podcast, the co-creator of the original Comic Book Price Guide, the original editor for Amelia Rules, and the creator of such great strips as Strange Attractors, A Gathering of Spells, and Tangled River. It's Michael Cohen.
Say hey.
And he's the executive producer and writer of Mystery Science Theater 3000, a former vice president of Archie Comics, and the creator of the Instagram sensation Sweetest Beasts. It's Harold Buchholz.
Hello.
Hey, guys. It's 1976. I say we just get into the strips.
Yep. Let's do it.
Sure.
All right. So if you guys out there want to follow along, what you could do is you hop on over to the old Unpacking Peanuts website. There you're going to sign up for the Great Peanuts Reread, and that'll get you one email a month from us letting you know what strips we're going to cover. That way, you can do a little homework ahead of time and read along with us. Other ways you can follow along, you can go to gocomics.com, type in peanuts as I read the date. You type it in there, and away you go. So let's get started. May 1st. Snoopy is atop what is left of his doghouse. It is one spindly-looking little twig and a rough hewn corner. Snoopy yells to the cat next door, "Hey, cat, I don't really appreciate this nick you put in my doghouse." He continues in the next panel, "But I'm going to forgive you. You want to know why I forgive you? Because that's the kind of guy I am. That's why," he says as he lays back down on what's left of his doghouse. But then in panel 4, he sits back up again and says, "Just don't ask to borrow any of my Joni James records again."
I had no idea what this was.
Oh, I would have assumed you would have known who Joni James was. I don't know who she is, but
I have no idea. I still don't.
This is fascinating to me. First off, just to focus on the strip itself. I know, Michael, you said you didn't particularly care for these strips. I love the way Schulz has drawn this slashing of his doghouse, which is becoming a regular thing this year. It almost looks like the cat was moving so fast with its claws that it actually caused a little singeing and burning.
Yeah,
well,
it does look burned. Yeah.
But I like the relationship with Snoopy. You know, you never see the cat. He's one of those off-screen characters. And I just love that it's "just don't ask to borrow any of my Joni James records again."
Again.
So, you know, there might be a more complex relationship between Snoopy and this cat than we are aware of.
But wouldn't the Joni James records be in the basement? Which isn't
they
there.
They must be in the basement rec room, yep.
But it's gone.
That's no where room. All the action is.
Yeah, well, that's maybe why he's saying it, right? It's somehow he's disintegrated all of that shellac. But Joni James, like, yeah, I think all three of us, we were like, this question mark popped up. And so I thought, okay.
Peanuts, obscurities, it's playing.
Maybe for some people, this is not an obscurity at all. But for us, apparently it is.
No idea.
And this is the thing that blew my mind. Joni James had 25 top 40 hits between 1952 and 1960 on the Billboard charts.
Must have been like country western or something.
Well, she did do a cover. Her number two went to number two. The second biggest selling song she ever did was when Hank Williams recorded "Your Cheatin' Heart."
Okay.
He passed away before it was released in 1953. And it went straight to number one on the country charts. But just a few months later, Joni James did a version of it that went to the general charts, and it peaked at number two. And that was the second biggest hit she ever had. But she did do a number one with "Why Don't You Believe Me." So these are songs that are, you know, often not played on the radio because it's just a little bit too old and not quite rock and roll. And
right, yeah.
But, you know, the fact that she had all of these hit songs and that she's not remembered, you know, among our generation at all is pretty crazy. I mean, I don't know who else has 25 top 40 hits that we wouldn't know who it is. I actually saw her on YouTube and was just watching some of her stuff. And yeah, she's kind of a little more old school in her performances. It's certainly not all, it's not all country by any stretch. It's just more kind of straight, you know, ballads and that sort of thing. But the thing that also blew me away is in 1953 and 1954, she had 8 songs in a row that charted. And it was like the most consistent charting I'd ever seen. It was like she had this dedicated fan base because the songs charted at 23, 27, 22, 22, 22, 23, 23, and 28.
Wow. Same exact amount of people going out every month or whatever it is.
That's right. The Joni James fan club was like, we are going to make a hit.
So do you think Charles Schulz was out there buying her records every week?
Schulz was a fan and a friend of Joni James.
Get out. All right.
Yeah. In fact, he drew Snoopy for a CD cover. One of the last things he ever drew outside of the strip was for her CD. So she was obviously involved. She just died last year.
Oh my gosh.
I think she was in her 90s. And it's pretty crazy that, there's this whole world of music that is just, I'm fascinated by things that just get forgotten after their era. And this is definitely one of them, at least for us.
Something that
my mom always had the radio. I was like a kid. But she had the radio on all the time. So a lot of the pop music of the 50s sounds familiar to me. I didn't know who was who, but
yeah. I heard. And I'm sure we've got listeners who are like, you guys don't know who Joni James.
Yeah, it's always embarrassing.
What's wrong with you?
Well, you can't know everything.
So yeah, if you're a Joni James fan, this list.
That's obscure.
Chime in, let us know. She's not alone.
I'm going to become a hardcore Joni James fan. I'm going to know everything. Next time you come back, I'm going to be like, I'll know everything about Joni James.
Crazy. What I find odd is the first panel. Now, if you couldn't talk and you were thinking really loud, would you open your mouth like you were screaming?
Yes. I might. Now, that is not to say I think it's a normal, appropriate behavior, but I might do it.
Yeah, this cat and Snoopy, there's something else going on here that we don't fully understand.
Yeah, it is very, very, very strange. That does make me laugh when you pointed out that he's just thinking hard. Oh, very funny. May 9th. Oh, no, it's a Mother's Day strip. Oh, Get ready, people. Oh, I know. Can't take it. All right. Poor little Woodstock is walking around with a flower and a MASH/ Small World Ride conglomeration of signs spelling out mother in different languages. Mom, I guess, actually in different languages. And in the next panel, we see him just with the flower. It's one of those old school 1950s super long flowers sitting on top of a hill. Snoopy comes up to see what's going on with this pal. So then Snoopy sees him sitting there and he thinks to himself / communicates to Woodstock, you know, you could sit here for the rest of your life waiting for your mom to fly by. Snoopy continues, she could be in Anchorage or in the Caribbean or Duluth for all you know. Or maybe she's in a birdcage somewhere. And this does not go over well with Woodstock. He is shocked at the very thought of this. And in the next panel, he is sobbing uncontrollably. And Snoopy's extremely upset. He says, oh, I didn't mean it. Cut out my tongue. But Woodstock's crying. Woodstock is still crying in the next panel. And Snoopy's still yelling, forget I said it. Forget I said it. And in the next panel, he hugs Woodstock tight, who's still holding on to the flower. And he says, there, there, little friend. Don't cry. Don't cry. Your mom's not in a birdcage. Don't cry. And Woodstock sniffs, but Woodstock is crying. And then in the next panel, Snoopy and Woodstock are sitting on top of the hill. And Snoopy has a little smile on his face. And he says, we'll just sit here together until your mom flies by. And then you can give her the flower. And then in the last panel, Snoopy says, who invents these stupid holidays anyway?
This is harsh.
It's really sad.
This is a beautiful and, sad strip. I mean, this relationship between these two characters is just, we just know them, and to see them go through this together is it really touches you.
Well, it's crazy, and you see that third from the last panel, and you've seen Snoopy hug Woodstock before, but it's always like a joyful hug, right?
Yeah.
And this is like this comforting hug. And again, you know, we've said it a million times with just the most minimal amount of drawing.
Yeah.
Clearly, Schultz was not a fan of these Hallmark holidays, which is funny considering how much.
Yeah, this is essentially biting the hand that feeds you a little bit. It's obliquely referring to Hallmark. If you're going to choose anybody who you think is really pushing the holidays, it's in Kansas City.
Yep. And, you know, obviously the loss of his mom right before he went to, I mean, you know,
yeah,
what a horrible thing to go through to right before you're off to war.
Yeah.
You lose your mother.
How lonely must that feel? Yeah.
Yes. And clearly here we are 35 years later, whatever, something like that. And he's still feeling it clearly.
Yeah. And it's just a masterful little strip. The second panel, the one, the throwaways, is a classic too. Where it's this little mound, very tall, rounded mound of grass that Woodstock is sitting toward the front of, with the flower facing away from Snoopy as he walks up. It's really nice, and definitely that hug, that third to last panel, a version of that has become so famous and so iconic for Peanuts. It's been in so many different things, of posters and, you know, the t-shirts and you name it, that really struck a chord with a lot of people for sure.
I always loved Woodstock because, you know, it was always a part of the strip since I was a little kid, but I love them a lot more since we started going through it strip by strip and doing this podcast. It's a very, very touching, sweet, sad comic strip. June 5th, we're at the old baseball field. Charlie Brown's atop the mound. Lucy's behind the mound, and she says to him, "You know what our team needs, Charlie Brown? It needs to promote." Charlie Brown says, "Promote what?" And Lucy answers, "Promote me to president." Then she walks away laughing. And Charlie Brown looks out at us and says, "I wonder if I could trade her to Charlie Finley."
This, you know, we got a doubleheader.
All right. Well, I do not know. Was he married to Joni James by any chance?
No, I can't say we had that much of a amazing serendipity. But again, it's so fun diving into these things that Schultz found interesting and thought at the time, this is going to fly as a punchline. Charlie Finley was the owner of the Oakland A's at the time. And he had owned them first. He'd bought them when they were the Athletes in Kansas City. And this guy is a huge character. So I'm guessing if you knew baseball at the time and you were really into all of the behind the scenes stuff, you knew this guy, especially living in California. And he tried to buy the Athletics back in 54 when he was only 36 years old, when they were in
Holy
Philly.
Cow.
And he was this crazy promoter character. He said he changed the elephant mascot with a live mule once he had bought it. He was always tinkering with the stuff he could affect. He has a Beatles tie-in.
Really?
He created the record for the most paid for a single concert to the Beatles by getting them to come to Kansas City. He paid $150,000 for them to do their 25-minute concert.
25-minute show, yeah.
Yeah, and he promised the people of Kansas City, I'm going to bring the Beatles to Kansas City. And, you know, they were all booked up. He called up Brian Epstein. He actually went to meet Brian.
Wow.
Twice. And Brian turned him down the first time. He said, "No, we don't have any breaks. We've got a New Orleans day off that time. We are not going to do it." And then so that's when it got up to $150,000. And then Brian,
you know, like, what? We could squeeze it in.
I think we could maybe make that work. And he's also somewhat infamous for pressuring them to tried to pressure them to make them play longer than a half an hour for their $150,000, which John really didn't appreciate after losing his New Orleans gig. So, and on the tickets, it said, "Charles O. Finley is pleased to present for the the enjoyment of the Beatles fans in Mid-America, the Beatles in person," with a photo of himself on the back of the Beatles wig.
That is amazing.
This guy is crazy. And he, I think, so the A's won like three World Series, 72, 74, 76. So they're definitely in the zeitgeist at the time. So maybe a decent number of people who knew who Finley was. But
And maybe Schultz himself had some contact with him. It seems like that's kind of a thing that could happen.
Right? I'm guessing this guy reached out to Schultz for something. You know, come on out to the A's day and, you know, meet Charles Schultz. But the other thing that he's famous for, I thought was hilarious, and it's kind of tied in here to what we're reading in this strip, is free agency had just hit baseball. And Fenley took advantage of that to sell off a bunch of his top players at really high prices. And the Major League Baseball commissioner stopped him. Because he's like, you're basically strip mining your team. And Fenley was so mad, he sued the baseball commissioner and lost. So, but
oh my God.
It's just crazy. He created a mechanical robot that would deliver new balls to the umpire at shows. I mean, he was a real character. Anyway, so that's the story.
Well, there you go. All right. Wow. This is the most educational podcast we've ever done.
Thanks, Wikipedia.
This is exciting.
Oh my God. And then he goes to Kansas City.
Kansas City. Here I come.
June 21st. Snoopy goes to Kansas City.
What is going on here?
He is on the back of a trolley car.
Beautifully drawn.
And beautifully drawn. He hops off in Kansas City saying, Kansas City. Then he thinks to himself, wow, what a place. And he's walking around and he thinks, I should send that round-headed kid another note or a card to let him know I'm all right. Then he thinks to himself, I wonder if you can get greeting cards in Kansas City. That's an in-joke.
Yeah.
It's because, of course, that's where Hallmark was.
Yeah, yeah.
Ah, see, like, I would not know this.
So I'm guessing.
I don't think many people.
You look at June 21st and then you go back to May 9th and we just read that the Mother's Day card. I'm guessing he's like, oh, I need to do a daily that maybe throws them a bone.
Yeah, you're probably right about that. Because I'm sure they were very up on what the current Peanut strip was doing. Because they're looking for art, they're looking for gags, all that stuff to fill their cards. Yeah, who comes up with these stupid holidays probably didn't go over great on that Monday morning.
this probably was scheduled to come out like the day before so that they would be in a forgiving mood. And maybe he went to Kansas City at this time as well. That's why I all got in there and met them.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely could be. But yeah, that's definitely a reference to good old Hallmark, who I imagine still make Peanuts cards to this day. I mean, I know because they've done all the little ornaments and stuff, and they have a long, long relationship with the Peanuts folks.
Yeah, they've done them good.
July 11th. We have a really psychedelic, abstract first panel with Snoopy as a silhouette atop his doghouse in front of a blazing, gigantic sun.
I think that was a blacklight Hallmark greeting card at one point.
Yeah, it probably was, yes. Panel 2, another throwaway, Snoopy and Woodstock atop the doghouse. Panel 3, Snoopy's looking up at the sky and he says, it looks like tomorrow will be another nice day. Red at night, sailor's delight, he says. Red in the morning, sailors take warning. This is an old thing he is quoting. So then he looks at Woodstock and says, red at noon, fly a balloon. This tickles Woodstock. Hee hee. Red at 10, a big fat hen. Woodstock can't get enough of this. That's a four laugher for Woodstock. Red at 3, kiss a bee. Red at 4, close the door. Woodstock is dying laughing. Red at 5, don't give me that jive. Woodstock laughs so hard that he falls off the doghouse. Snoopy rolls his eyes and says, red before bed, how's your head? And Woodstock, again, thinks that's hilarious. Lots of hee 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 hees.
Oh my gosh. This was my mother-in-law's one of her very favorite Peanut strips. She loved this strip. And I remember it really fondly because I think this is the beginning of the two characters getting so silly on the doghouse that they fall off and hit their head, which becomes a recurring theme, I think, through the second half of Peanuts. So this is a little moment of history as well.
Very cute.
I've seen other ones that were like years later. He was still doing this motif of them getting silly.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I'm sure it goes into the 90s, 100%. July 27th. All right, we're in the middle of a story here where a young lad has insulted Marcy by calling her lamb cake, and she has flattened him. So we pick it up with the kid flattened, just lying there on the ground. Peppermint Patty and Marcy are there. Marcy looks still angry, and Peppermint Patty says to her, "Marcy, you can't slug somebody for calling you lamb cake." The kid wakes up. He's like, "What happened? Where am I?" Peppermint Patty says, "Sorry, kid. My friend here doesn't understand." And then the little boy who Marcy flattened says to Peppermint Patty, "I like your friend. I think she's cute, sir." And this causes Peppermint Patty to go off, and she kicks him in the butt, yelling, "Don't call me sir."
Wow, this poor kid. He's just not dealing with the right two people.
What do you guys think of Marcy's, razor, or what would you call it? A hair trigger temper.
Yeah, right. She's a really interesting character. And I've actually really enjoyed reading the Marcy strips this year, getting to know her a little better.
Yeah. What do you think, Michael? What are your feelings about Marcy at this point, having come to her fairly recently?
I do like the character. I guess she's used to being laughed at because she thinks this kid's laughing at her. Mm. That's what I'm.
Yeah, right.
He's making fun of her by calling her lamb. Right. She just doesn't understand how the world works.
Yeah. I guess that is right. Although these days the kid would get punched again, probably.
So. She's ahead of her time. But yeah. I love the clouds in that first panel. It seems like in Peppermint Patty's world, we've mentioned this before, things can subtly change in terms of the background that the world that she lives in. It's just got that more, that looser, well, we were kind of saying kind of that grungy 70s vibe.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he definitely puts a little bit extra, moxie on the line to make it just a little bit rougher for some reason. And I don't know if it was conscious or subconscious, but if we're just crazy, it could be that too.
I was just thinking, we were talking about how Schultz kind of loosened his line up over the years.
Yeah.
And how that probably led a lot of other creators to do it. But I was just thinking, like, who was doing that before Schultz or
Pfeiffer?
Pfeiffer was doing it. And I think Johnny Hart was doing it too.
Yeah.
What do you mean? The kind of little funny looking clouds and abstract.
Yeah, like the loose abstract.
And the looser or wobbly pen lines.
Crazy cat, where it's just all surreal backgrounds.
Usher too.
Yeah. Well, there certainly was this. There was kind of that scratchy, goofy screwball style for years earlier, but it seems like it really cleaned up like in the 40s. And then you see it. It's so pristine with Schultz when he's beginning in the 50s. And then, yeah, he's just, I don't know if he's seeing other artists and following what they're doing, or he's just marching to his own drummer.
One thing that's interesting that we don't really think about a lot is, these things are being reproduced in these newspapers, and they're being reproduced on newsprint. They're being reproduced on different presses all over the country, all over the world. I think probably there was a general movement towards a cleaner, more graphic, more maybe slightly more minimalist style in general, partly because of that. And of course, we know that the shrinking size of the comics affects it all.
Yeah, and you definitely see it here. I mean, look at the size of this lettering compared to, say, what it was in the mid-50s. It's huge. And does it seem like his line art has the extent of the thicks and thins kind of maybe... It goes more to this kind of thicker middle ground. I don't know if he's changed size of what he was working with, because we know he's been using the same tool for a while, or are we just looking at consistently reproduced images that kind of tend to thicken up? I don't know. I maybe one of our listeners at the museum who can go back and look and say, when did that strip change size? If he didn't change his tools, why does it look thicker here in the 70s? The line look thicker. And I love the look actually here of these strips in the 70s, although I do miss a little bit of the thicks and thins that I felt like I was seeing that were a little more defined in the late 60s.
Yeah. One of the things I find, and this is, there's a couple things I want to say here. First off, I ran into a friend of mine recently and said, "Oh, what are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, we're doing this podcast about Peanuts." And he said, "Oh, that's great, because you know everything about Peanuts." And I thought, I hope no one thinks I think that.
No way.
Like, you know what I mean? I'm doing this podcast so I can learn things about Peanuts, not that I know everything.
I'm in awe of what some people know about Peanuts. I mean, and when some of them are writing us, and telling us all these things.
Oh, yeah.
We just have no clue about whole huge swaths of Schultz. And
yeah. And at the heart of it, you know, I'm a fan of it. Like, I mean, this is why I became a cartoonist. I love it. So one of the things that's funny with me is whatever era I'm looking at, I am always like, oh, you know what? This is my favorite. I think this is the best. And it doesn't matter where that's it great. Is, you know, like 1956. Now this is my favorite. 1976. Now this. Yeah. I'm ultimately just a fan, as we all are. August 7th. This storyline is now continuing with a very cute drawing of Peppermint Patty and Marcy in their little camp bunks right next to each other. And Peppermint Patty says to Marcy, "Was lamb cake such a bad thing to be called, Marcy? What about noodle neck or cement head? People call each other lots of strange things without being really serious. You should think about that, Marcy." Marcy rolls over and says, "I will. Good night, noodle neck."
Yeah, there's a hardened defensiveness in Marcy here that's like, oh, she's been hurt.
Yeah, I think Michael's theory is right that she can't conceive of this as the kid actually thought she was cute or whatever. She thought she was being made fun of.
Yeah, and I really feel sorry for Marcy that she's going to sleep with her glasses on, especially when she's rolling over into the pillow. That's got to be all.
Well, she would reveal that she has no eyes.
She looks like Little Orphan Annie if she takes her glasses off.
Yeah. August 8th. We're back at the good old baseball field. Charlie Brown's on the mound, of course, and his trusty catcher Schroeder comes up and says, "Let's go over our signals again, Charlie Brown. We'll keep them simple." Schroeder continues, "One finger will mean a fastball. Two fingers will mean a curve. Three will mean a drop. Four fingers is a knuckleball. Five is a slider. And six is a forkball." Good old Schroeder continues, "Seven fingers will mean an upshoot, eight fingers a duster, nine fingers a knuckle curve, 10 fingers a palm ball, 11 fingers will mean a pitch out, 12 a roundhouse curve, 13 a changeup, and 14 your fast side armor. 15 fingers will mean a sinker, 16 fingers will mean a screwball, and 17 fingers an overhead curve." Schroeder finally finishes, and they're both atop the pitcher's mound, and Schroeder says, "Okay." Charlie Brown says, "Okay." And Schroeder starts walking back behind the plate. Then he turns and says, "On second thought, I have a better idea. Throw anything you want."
That is one laborious setup for a joke.
You know, I thought about that when I was looking at this. I thought, I don't know that I'd want, even if I had this joke, I wouldn't want a letter at all.
Well, I wouldn't want to read it. I mean, out loud. So it could have been a 4-panel strip. First two panels, last two panels. There you go.
Oh, yeah. First two, not counting the throwaway panels.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Although, it's funny that that he's going over the allotted number of fingers.
That's definitely funny. You know?
Yeah.
Given that he's a pianist, you think he might know.
Yeah. How many fingers? Well, I actually do remember in Little League, kids having all kinds of signs for the pitcher. And in Little League, you can't. It's 40 feet away. The ball's not going to curve anyway, even if you could throw a curve, which you can't. But it'd be like, all right. I knew a kid who thought he had a devastating knuckle curve at 10. August 9th. Good old Snoopy's atop the doghouse, pounding away at his typewriter. Charlie Brown comes up and says, "I hear you're writing a book on theology." He walks away saying, "I hope you have a good title." And Snoopy thinks, "I have the perfect title." And he types it. "Has it ever occurred to you that you might be wrong?" One for the Hall of Fame, I think, and one that was very articulately spoken about by our pal Stephen Lynn from A Charlie Brown Religion. Hey, Liz, can we go back in the old time machine and hear what he had to say?
Why, certainly. It's time for the peanut.
That line.
I think that's so brilliant.
It really is. And one of the things that was really fun for me to hear when I was talking with Schultz's family and friends was that apparently Schultz would use that line, "Has it ever occurred to you that you might be wrong?" Just in casual conversation, he would jab some of his friends and family with that on occasion. He uses it at least twice in the strips. He uses it in another occasion where Linus is away at summer camp. Turns out it's a church camp, and there's some end times preaching that Linus does not fully agree with. And so Linus asks the camp counselor that same question. to me, this is at least half of Charles Schulz's faith. Has it ever occurred to you that you might be wrong? And right. This is not to say that Schulz was somebody who didn't believe. I think it's quite the opposite. This is somebody who believed with a sincerity and a depth that allowed himself to ask, in what ways might I not know? In what ways might I be wrong? And he was often struck by the maybe overconfidence of other religious thinkers, or thinkers just of probably any subject, who would be so dogmatic in their position that, of course, they could not ever be wrong. And so Schulz is asking us here, in his own simple comic strippy sort of way, he's really in a deeper way asking us, does your theology ever allow you to doubt? Does your perspective on faith allow you to ask what you don't know and in what ways you might never know? And that is the Great Pumpkin side to the Charlie Brown Christmas version of theology. And the two for Schulz go hand in hand, that yes, you can believe, and yes, you can also doubt.
All right. Well, that was Stephen Lind. And if you guys want to check out his book, A Charlie Brown Religion, you should do that. You can get it on the old Amazon. It's really an excellent book. Highly recommended. 5 stars. August 10th, Snoopy is continuing to write his theology book. He writes Theology and the Dog. Charlie Brown is now reading it. As it says in the 9th chapter of Ecclesiastes, a living dog is better than a dead lion. Charlie Brown says, what does that mean? Snoopy says, I don't know, but I agree with it.
Agree with it, too.
Sure, right?
Right?
I mean, who would disagree?
I think there was
a lion, maybe a Harold Lion character might not like it.
There was a movie from, was it the late 80s, early 90s, called Something Wild with Melanie Griffith?
Ray Liotta.
And that same quote is brought up multiple times in that movie, if I remember correctly. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it's just really, really wild.
They're clearly big Peanuts fans. And, you know, Snoopy proving again that he is well-read in his scripture and, of course, his classics as well. But he is a very refined dog. All right, guys, I think this is a good place to take a break. Why don't we do that? And you characters can take this moment to do a couple things if you wanted to. If you haven't signed up for the Great Peanuts Reread, you should do that. You could go to our website, unpackingpeanuts.com. And if you sign up for that once a month, my pal Harold will send you a little newsletter and it will let you know what comic strips we are going to be covering that particular month. So that'll be very helpful for you if you want to read ahead. So you could do that. You could also follow us on social media. We're Unpack Peanuts on Twitter, Instagram, and Threads, and Unpacking Peanuts on Facebook. And you can always just shoot us an email too at unpackingpeanuts@gmail.com. So if you need to do any of those things, follow us, send us an email, or subscribe to the newsletter, do that, and we'll be right back.
Hi, everyone. You've heard us rave about the Esterbrook Radio 914. And what episode would be complete without mention of the Fab Four? Now you can wear our obsessions proudly with Unpacking Peanuts t-shirts. We have a Be of Good Cheer pen nib design, along with the four of us crossing Abbey Road, and of course, Michael, Jimmy, and Harold at the Thinkin' Wall. Collect them all, trade them with your friends. Order your t-shirts today at unpackingpeanuts.com/store.
And we're back, 1976. We're coming on the end of the year here, but first, let's see what's in the mailbag in our new segment, Sitting in the Mailbox.
The mail's in.
We got lots of mail this week.
Oh, wow.
Some great ones. Our super listener, Kathy in Eastern Washington, writes, I find it so bizarre that when listening to the podcast, I persist in picturing a very specific seating arrangement in the same room, even though I know only Liz and Michael are in the same room. Jimmy and Michael sit next to each other at a longish table.
Okay.
If it were a plane, Michael would be in the aisle seat and Jimmy in the window. Harold sits on the other side of the table, and there's a nondescript bunch of equipment on the table, partially blocking Michael and Harold's view of each other. Liz is about 15 feet behind the table, almost in another room. In fact, It's so weird, but it's always in my head as I'm listening.
My question is this. Do I have hair in this scenario?
Kathy, you'll have to write and tell us. So I have a mental picture of what podcasters look like, but I've never like pictured them in space.
That's fascinating.
Oh, I have a picture of the screw it. Let's just talk about the Beatles. Yeah, I have them all sitting in one room on the floor. They're not even in chairs.
It is very, very strange. And it's always disappointing when these people never look how you imagine in their head.
Yeah. So can we describe where we are just to give people a reality check?
I'm on the purple couch.
Oh.
Okay. The purple couch. So you guys know that.
Nice. With my laptop.
I'm actually at my art desk in the studio.
I'm actually sitting with my back against the wall on kind of sideways on a full-size bed.
Nice. I'm going to have to get a new art desk soon, which is depressing because this has been around with me since the mid-90s and it is on its last legs.
You can donate it to the Comic Book Hall of Fame or some such. I saw Jack Kirby's drawing desk.
Oh, yeah. I've seen Schultz's. And one of my moments of impressing anybody in life that's happened like two or three times. I was at the Disney studios and the art director goes, I bet you don't know whose desk this is. He drew Mickey Mouse. And I said, oh, is it Floyd Gottfredson? And he was so excited. And I got a picture of me sitting at Floyd Gottfredson's desk. It was very cool.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, but no, we're not sitting on a plane.
No, but now you can have all sorts of weird pictures of the couch next to a bed in the office.
So in response to our Snoopy Personas episode, Pui McCleary writes, if you're looking for a comic strip precedent for Snoopy, perhaps you should look at Tige, who was Buster Brown's dog during the early 1900s. From what I remember, Tige seemed to be more than a normal dog. He made faces at the reader and seemed self-aware to some extent. Another possible precedent could be Mr. O'Malley from Barnaby, the cigar-chomping fairy godfather who may or may not be real. This comic did feature a talking dog and other magical folk whom only Barnaby could see. Not quite the same as putting on personas or perhaps costumes as Snoopy does, but certainly examples of cartooning that Schultz would have known.
Yeah, those are good calls. You know, it's hard to even overstate how huge R.F. Outcault was. I mean, he originally created the Yellow Kid, which is considered by many like the first newspaper comic, or is it just historically known as the first newspaper comic strip? I mean, it's what, 1896 or whatever. He created that and then was lured away from that syndicate to create Buster Brown, right? I think that's right, Harold?
Well, yeah, Buster Brown, I think the mention of Tige is a really interesting one because there are all these things we take it for granted now. And when we go back in time and we kind of see, if you go back in time and you see these things kind of getting shaved away that doesn't exist, but there's Tige. Yeah, around the turn of the century, yeah, and he's mugging to the audience. He's he's aware that people are reading him, which was was obviously the Yellow Kid was absolutely all about that. He's like looking at us with his yellow nightgown, and it's got the wording on the nightgown, which is a very also unique and odd and surreal creative thing that he just kind of invented, as far as I know. But yeah, Tige is a good call to say that Tige was a groundbreaker because that a cartoonist, he was amazingly, amazingly creative. And I think he probably introduced a lot of things that we're not aware of into the strips that other people copied.
Yeah, hugely popular. And then even to the point that when I was a child in the 70s, Buster Brown shoes were still insanely popular. People, I mean, not popular like Air Jordans, but I mean, they were children's shoes for kids to wear to school, basically. And they were Buster Brown.
Yeah.
I can still sing the theme song to the Buster Brown shoes.
Oh, let's hear it.
I'll put it at the end of the episode.
Okay, good.
Wow. And are they still going? Because I know in the 90s, they were still a thing.
I don't know. Yeah, I have no idea.
And there was a Broadway production with Tige, So, certainly that wasn't a first for Peanuts to be having a Snoopy on stage. Tige was there in 1905. So It's pretty crazy.
And Mr. O'Malley from Barnaby. Now, if you guys aren't super hardcore fans of comic strips out there, you might not know this one, but you probably know Crockett Johnson, who created it, if nothing else, from Harold and the Purple Crayon, which is, you know, a beloved, famous children's book that basically features Barnaby, the main character from this comic strip, Barnaby, just renamed Harold.
Oh, that's nice of him.
Because that's a great name. But yeah, Barnaby is, or Mr. O'Malley is Barnaby's fairy godfather, who may or may not be real. Yeah, I can sort of see that as a fantasy character, certainly. And, you know, it had a very, very spare graphic style, which may have influenced Schultz.
Shall I go on? We still have
more. Yeah, keep going.
Okay, so Jesse Fuchs writes, "Gentlemen, I discovered your podcast thanks to your great interview with Ivan Brunetti and have been enjoying going back through the archives since. On Blue Sky, Jesse is currently trying to spark debate about whether Woodstock is a cryptid because he has braces on July 14th, 73, and his bar fight damage on October 27th, 1980. And unlike any modern bird extant, has teeth. Your expertise will be appreciated."
Well, that's a Michael question, clearly. Is Woodstock some sort of cryptozoologist?
Does he have teeth?
He does, and yes, he does.
So he's an ornith. I can't remember what. He's based on coming out of the raptor family, but
there you go.
A winged raptor creature.
Well, there you go. That is definitive. Woodstock is merely
Archaeopteryx was the first.
Archaeopteryx?
Member of the bird family. At least when in 1950 he was. Things have probably changed.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, I think that settles it for me. Harold, what do you have a take on this?
Oh no, I think I'm going to defer to Michael on this one for sure.
All right, we are all deferring to Michael. That sounds good.
Jesse goes on to point out a mistake that we might have made.
Uh-oh.
Never.
He says, "I don't think they ever played poker, though I could be wrong, and would be delighted if there was an example or two out there. But the vast majority of the time, the birds are playing contract bridge."
Bridge. Yeah, yeah. Oh. Schultz was a huge bridge player. I have a question. Does anyone know how to play bridge? Any of you three?
I've been playing since I was 8.
Really?
Have you really?
I have.
I've never played.
Well, I was always amazed by it because, you know, you read the comics as a kid and right next to it was all this like Goron on bridge kind of stuff. And it was like, there's a daily column on how to play bridge better that ran for like 100 years. So, you know, there must be something to this game. If you can.
I remember when I moved to Harrisburg in the 90s, that column was in the Harrisburg Patriot with the little diagrams of hearts and spades and stuff from each seat to show you how to play.
Yeah, it was like learning how to do Morse code, as far as I could tell. I was just like,
yeah, I have no idea.
Our last message is from Joanne Rubenstein, and she is writing in response to the world famous grocery clerk.
All right.
And she says, "Regarding running the cash register, another part was to push the no tax key before ringing in non-taxable items."
Oh my gosh.
"She got hired at MediMart and she asked for a list of those items and was told there was no list, just use common sense."
Oh.
"She was 16 and had no common sense. So she hit the no tax key willy-nilly and hoped for the best."
Brilliant.
Wow. Made a lot of friends at the checkout.
I am so happy that she wrote this, because this brings back a really strong memory of mine that I haven't thought about in a long time. Yeah, you know, I worked at a grocery store and I started as a bag boy. And then when I was getting my promotion to checkout clerk, I had to go to a school for like 3 days in Scranton, which was like over an hour away from me. So it was me and two girls from my store. Drove up, and there was another guy from another store who was doing the training at the same time. And they had in like Scranton, Wilkes-Barre area, a whole Acme. That was the name of the supermarket I worked at. That wasn't a real Acme. It was just for training. And it was
really,
it was crazy. Yes. It was a full grocery store filled with boxes that had nothing in it. And you would have to go do this. And one of the last things was the taxable, non-taxable test. And like, they want you to pass. Like, you know what I mean? It's like they will do anything. So we took the test and three of us passed, but the guy from the other store did not.
Oh.
And so when you don't pass, they just basically do it with you, do it with the whole group orally so that you have to pass. And it's like, okay, question one, bleach. Now, is bleach taxable or non-taxable? And the guy goes, non-taxable. And the guy goes, no. Now think about it. Can you drink bleach? And the guy goes, yes.
Oh. Oh, no.
He worked through it. He still became cashier.
And became president of the United States.
And that's how I met him.
It just shows what you can do in this America. Well, so I have a question. So I'm assuming you had the cash registers, Jimmy, that were like the modern calculators with the easy touch buttons. Because the thing that really struck me with those old cash registers is those things mm-hmm. look like heavy duty, more than typewriter kind of buttons.
We did have them, they weren't working though. They were in the office, but they still had two of them.
Oh, wow.
So I know what you're talking about. And they are big buttons that you really have to push down.
You'd have to build some muscles, right? I mean, that's like typing all day nonstop.
And the worst thing about it though, is because this was like, I don't know what it was like 1990 or whatever, you know, and you'd be scanning a bunch of stuff. And then one of those would come up with the purple writing on it. And you'd be like, oh no, I have to do it myself. Oh, it's terrible.
Oh, yeah, right. They used to have those little purplish things that, with the circle around it with the price.
Yeah.
Boy, that's a blast from the past.
Yeah. So you can't drink bleach, though, people. So it is, in fact, taxable.
Thank you.
All right. Is that the mailbag?
Yes, that's the mailbag for this week. And thank you, everyone.
Wow.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for writing. As always, we would love to hear from you. You can... do that, like I said, by checking us out on social media at Unpack Peanuts and Unpacking Peanuts on Facebook. Or you could just send us an email, unpackingpeanuts@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. And remember, you know, if I don't hear from you, I worry. So, all right, let's get back to the strips. August 16th, Charlie Brown is firing one in from the old pitcher's mound. And of course, it comes flying right back out at him, knocking all his clothes off and sending him on his back on top of the mound. Lucy comes over and says, I'm a reporter for our school paper, Charlie Brown. Can anything be done about violence in sports? Charlie Brown sits up in just his shorts and says, tell them not to hit the ball so hard.
I would really like to see more of Lucy as the reporter for the school paper.
She would be a good investigative reporter.
You'd think that would be... the start of something big, but she never did. Did she?
Well, I liked her as the pollster when Linus was running for class president.
Yeah.
That's a neat role for her to have because, you know, she wants to shape the world, but, you know, sometimes reporting is not enough for her.
Yeah.
Which makes it kind of interesting for her. Yeah.
Boy, that's a great character, though, that really, you know, the school reporter, the classroom. They do that in Harry the Spy at the end. But boy, that's something that really hasn't been explored that much.
Wait a minute. What was that TV series? The fake documentary. Oh. A fake documentary about a horrible crime at a school.
Basically,
someone spray painted like the dicks on the
school's car.
And the main characters were like the school reporter and they're
What's that called?
American Vandal.
Oh, there you go.
Season two, good seasons.
Yeah, well, I agree that is a really interesting setting to have student journalists who are like, you know, kids, because mm-hmm. you know you can deal with all the ethical questions that come up about journalism, right? And mm-hmm. and ones that are like would be like Lucy would be shaping their own world, and yeah.
September 5th. Woodstock, in one of those symbolic panels, is all decked out in a top hat and putting on the Ritz cane. But in the next panel, he seems very upset, sighing atop Snoopy's doghouse as they both sit there. Then in the next panel, a very wistful and forlorn Woodstock asks Snoopy a question. In the next panel, they hop off the doghouse without a word, and they walk somewhere. Panel after that, Snoopy shows Woodstock a glowing streetlight. Then they walk back, a big smile on both of their faces, but particularly Woodstock, as Snoopy thinks Woodstock is happy now. And they both go back to the top of the doghouse, and Snoopy thinks he can finally say that he's seen the lights of the city.
Big smile on Woodstock's face.
Yeah, he's easy to please.
He is easy to please. I sort of, when I wanted to go to a city, when I was, look, I grew up in the tiniest little town in the world, and I thought every city was like New York. And we went to Shamokin once, and my dad goes, oh, you know, you always wanted to see a city. This is officially a city. Shamokin, Pennsylvania is not officially a city. It's a huge disappointment if that's what you're going for. It's about the equivalent of what Woodstock got here.
I know Shamokin from a Alan Sherman song.
Really?
Really?
Shamokin. Yeah. Was it a Borscht Belt? I always assumed it was a Borscht Belt town.
No, just coal region. September 26th. Snoopy is feeling restless. He thinks to himself, I'm restless. He's still atop his doghouse and he thinks, I can't hang around here all day. He proceeds to continue to hang around for the next panel, though. He says, I feel like going to the park. Let's take a vote on it. His stomach says something that we can't read. And Snoopy says, they don't have anything to eat there. Stomachs never want to go any place where you don't eat. Then his nose, by the way, for you guys at home, you try reading and describing this thing. So then his nose thinks a question mark. So in the next panel, Snoopy says, the nose never knows. How about the ears? All right, ears, pay attention. The ears are shaking. And the trouble with ears, they never listen. Do you want to go to the park or don't you? The trouble with ears, they never listen. It's pretty cute. The next panel, this is still going on. And he says, if there's a band playing, that's what the ears think. How do I know if there's going to be a band playing? Now he looks down at the feet. He goes, there's no use in even asking the feet. Feet always want to stay home. I don't care what any of you say, Snoopy says as he jumps off the doghouse. We're going to the park. I'm still in charge. Yes, you have it all together, Snoopy. It never fails. They all complain about going, but after we get here, they all have a good time. And he's doing a little Snoopy dance.
So this is some kind of psychiatric condition.
He's having problems. It's going south, I think. When you're having conversations with your own body parts.
Yeah, and I love the comics rule that, you know, Snoopy thinks with thought balloons, but his stomach right. speaks and his nose. And whenever you have a question mark or an exclamation point, that has a pointer on it. It's not thought.
Right.
When you think, a question mark would be a thought.
That's true. This is weird. It's a very weird. But, you know, it's also like grows out of the idea of what can I make have consciousness? Can the school building have it be conscious? Yeah. Can the baseball pitcher's mound have consciousness? Can my dog's toes? It's very strange. October 16th. Now, this is the end of a long sequence where Peppermint Patty has decided that she needs a change of schools so she could do better. And she accidentally enrolls in Ace Obedience School, which is obviously an obedience school for dogs. And,
but not to her.
You know what? But not to her. She thinks it's a regular school. It's very, very strange. She's doing well at it, though. And apparently they don't have a problem. But, I'm having trouble even remembering what this storyline is. Can someone remind me, like, why the lawyer is here? I can't remember at all.
Well, because they're saying that she's gotten this diploma from the obedience school, so she doesn't have to go to school anymore. And the principal calls her in and has the conversation. And so she thinks she needs to bring her lawyer, Snoopy, in to defend the fact that she has this legitimate diploma. And Snoopy's the one who put her up to this in the first place.
He
can't resist being lawyer. So he's getting himself into this incredibly difficult situation where if she finds out what this is while he's there, he's in big trouble. But he still wants to put the bow tie on. He's there with her at the principal's office.
And he is anxious to leave here because here we are. She has him by the collar/bow tie in panel one. She's like, excuse me, sir. She's talking to the principal. And Snoopy's trying to get away. She's hanging onto the back of the bow tie. I don't know why my attorney is so anxious to leave. Then, as Michael says, panel three, you just got to see it. Snoopy is desperately trying to get out of here. Anyway, that's my diploma from the Ace Obedience School. And at this point, Peppermint Patty catches on and she yells, "What?" as she lets go of the collar and Snoopy looks like rolls out of the panel.
I really, really, really did not like this sequence.
Yeah, this was my least favorite of the year.
It's so weird because, you know, we know she's bad at school, but just says she's stupid.
Yeah, there is an element of Peppermint Patty where she just willfully sees what she wants to see. And a lot of times I feel like that really works because it's an interesting I mean, I know people like that. I can be a person like this. I don't think I could be so closed off that I would accidentally enroll in an obedience school. And I mean, I know, you know, believability is not really, you know, the gold standard here. But for me, this was my least favorite of the year.
Yeah, I kind of enjoyed it. I didn't mind the surreality of it. It seemed to be kind of consistent with the strip at this point. And there are a lot of really funny set pieces, and this being one of them.
Yes.
with Snoopy, you know, Snoopy the lawyer being brought back. And then you've got a really interesting side of Marcy that you're seeing. Mm-hmm. Because once Peppermint Patty, you know, Marcy knows obviously this is an obedience school, and it's funny, she won't really like hit Peppermint Patty over the head with the fact that it's an obedience school. I think she's kind of angry that Peppermint Patty doesn't see reality. Because, I mean, Peppermint Patty thought Snoopy was a kid. So this is not out of line with what we've seen with Peppermint Patty before. But there was at least a couple times after Peppermint Patty's kind of like, "Hey, I never have to go to school again." You know, the punchline is Marcy just kind of angrily glaring at her and saying, "Heel, sir." And, you know, I, again, this could only exist in this strip, what he's built up here. And while, yeah, I kind of get the uncomfortable nature of that, you really have to stretch far to go along with this. I did enjoy it because, yeah, it's a world he's created and he's taken me out on a limb and I'm willing to hang on.
Look, even the worst ones I always enjoy. I mean, you know, like I said.
Yeah. And I love the little thing where she's you see her running around the obedience course.
Yes.
It's just like obedience course. Why aren't any of the other kids doing it? They're just having their dogs do it, you know. You're getting to see her logic and I do see one little oddball thing in this strip where Schultz forgets something in his drawing that, you know, happens to you when you're a cartoonist on a deadline every once in a while. Do you guys see what I'm talking about? It's very minor.
That eyebrow.
No eyebrow on panel one.
Well, there's something else on panel one that's not there.
Oh, her freckles.
Yeah, no freckles.
Yeah.
But it's such a great drawing of Snoopy in all three of these first panels. Yeah, it's great. It's fun.
Yep. Ooh, it's Halloween, October 31st. We see the symbolic panel of a tiny little ghost atop a tree, probably Woodstock in a costume. That's amazing, right? I think we should have a whole strip of just the ghosts, like, you know.
Yeah, you think Woodstock would get a rock with that outfit.
Yes. So by the time the strip really starts on tier two, Woodstock walks up and this is actually very strange. He walks up and he sees this pumpkin, but we only see it from behind. Then in the next panel, we actually see the front, which means Schultz has flipped the drawing 180 degrees, which is a big no-no, but he has done it because he can, and who's going to tell him otherwise. So in panel four, we see that it's a jack-o'-lantern and this has scared Woodstock. Woodstock goes back to Snoopy's house and explains what's going on to him, and now he seems actually annoyed by it. But he goes back to his little nest and with a wicked grin on his face is seen carving something on something else. And then in the last panel, we see Woodstock with a tiny little smiley face jack-o'-lantern in his nest, looking very content with himself. And Snoopy says, "That's good, but how many people are you going to scare with a grape?"
I just love this. This Woodstock is just such a great character. And the fact that even in his little devilish moment where he's going to scare people, he winds up with the cutest little smiley face you ever had on that grape. That's just so wonderfully Woodstock.
It's great. Great Woodstock. What do you guys think about that second tier with the switch from the back of the pumpkin to the front of the pumpkin? I mean, that is strange.
Thinking about it, it's bizarre because it's not necessary.
Mm-mm. What do you mean?
He's surprised when he sees it, but he could definitely do away with the panel before and just do the middle one. Also, if you're flipping sides, he should be on the other side. So that's more disturbing.
No. If you took the camera and rotated it 180 degrees, that's, you know what I mean?
Well, he's got to get Woodstock from, I guess he could have had Woodstock like walking on the ground. So you at least get the sense of motion that he's going to this other place. But both of them work so incredibly well and they're so incredibly clean. I didn't even think about it. And I had absolutely no problem with, I mean, it's only that it's breaking a rule that somebody said is a rule that I would have any problem with it at all.
Well, yeah. But the reason it's a rule is because 99.9% of the time it will be confusing to the point that you're not sure what's happening. It'll look like people switch places.
Right. But what Schultz is working with here is he's seeing one side of something and it's clearly, and he's got the thing going off to an angle, like the little stalk is going off to one side. So he's got all the clues that obviously this is the other side. So you don't need any more in this world. There, you have the point of reference that you need. So this, at least to me, it's not jarring at all.
No, it wasn't just jarring. It's more jarring when you're explaining it, though. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
November 23rd. So Snoopy is atop his doghouse wearing his famous mustache disguise, which I always thought looked like a Bill Melendez mustache. He says, "How is this?" He says to Woodstock. And he stands up and he says, "This is one of my famous disguises. I'll loan it to you till Thanksgiving is over." This is because Woodstock is very afraid that he might be eaten as a turkey on Thanksgiving. Snoopy says, "If you wear this disguise, no one will mistake you for a turkey." And Woodstock in the last panel puts the mustache on, but he puts it on top of his head and it makes it look like a little, like a flipped up bob hair.
Yeah, it kind of looks like Marlo Thomas and That Girl.
Yeah, very.
So this was my one laugh out loud moment for the year.
More so than the next one? Oh my gosh.
Well,
the next one.
They're both very good.
All right, let's take a look at that one. November 24th. "Hey, that looks pretty good," says Snoopy as he's looking at something. "From a distance, I'd never recognize you. Come closer, let's see." And then in the last panel, we see Woodstock in his disguise. It's a bowler hat, a giant pipe, and the mustache now in correct place. And Snoopy says, "Let's try it without the pipe." Now, what do you like about this? Just the actual drawing of it, or just that Woodstock's character in the strips?
It's just a hilarious image. I mean, his beak becomes the nose.
Those are really, really, really cute strips.
Yeah, it's neat. Snoopy looking off with a big smile as it's as he's coming to him, and he thinks it actually looks pretty good from a distance. So that's probably what matters, right? So
that really is what matters. Yes.
But
pipe sticking in there? It's not in his mouth.
No, it must be like, maybe, I don't know. It's affixed somehow, some sort of a harness.
So with so little time left in this year, this is as close as I can get us to a segue for us to do the anger and happiness index.
Oh, that's a good segue.
So let's check where we were in 1975. We had 85 angry strips and 106 happy strips. How did this year feel to you guys for anger and happiness? What do you think for anger is? Is it up or down?
I think anger is exactly the same. It has not changed a bit.
How about you, Michael?
Oh, it's down a little bit.
Well, it's actually gone from 85 to 92, so it hasn't changed much. It's up a little. Yeah. And, so 75, we had quite a few more happy strips. We had 106.
You didn't let me guess. I was going to guess 106.
Well, that was back in 1975. Are you saying it hasn't changed? You were going to say 106.
No, well, no, I was lying, but now I have to say 106.
Now you, well, I'll
I say
you...
it's 106.
It's exactly 111.
It's actually way up. It's 130. So 36%. And one thing I've noticed, which I think is kind of cool. So Schultz got married in 73. And every year since 72, his happiness index has gone up to 1970.
Oh, that's actually really nice. All right. So we're on an upward happy trajectory. November 28th, symbolic panel here, Woodstock in a chef's hat, sitting on top of a loaf of bread. And then the next panel, we see him out in a very desolate, wintry landscape, looking at some breadcrumbs. And then this brings him back to Snoopy's house, and Snoopy says, "Those are breadcrumbs. There's nothing wrong with eating breadcrumbs. People have been throwing breadcrumbs out to birds for thousands of years." Woodstock says something else, and then hops off the doghouse, and Snoopy says, "I'm sure they wouldn't think that at all." That Woodstock is so proud, thinks Snoopy. Then he lies back down, thinking, he doesn't want anyone to get the impression that he's on welfare.
This is really a rare foray into current politics.
Yeah,
right after an election too. It was during an election he drew it.
Yeah.
So who was running in 76? That would have been Ford and Carter.
Yes.
So I want to ask you, you're talking about like crossing the axis in the comics with the Jack Lantern. Is that what he's doing from panel 2 to panel 3 again? Basically, we're crossing his line of sight?
No, he's just turned. Woodstock is just
turned. He's looking around.
Yeah, right. He looked right, and then he looked to his left. If they had switched the whole thing, those little squiggly brushes would be on the opposite side.
Because it looks like the breadcrumbs are like also a mirror image of him. Like he didn't change what he's looking at, because they're kind of strewn out in front of his line of sight evenly on either side. And then he's looking the other way. They're strewn out evenly on either side of his line of sight. So that's why I was asking.
You're not supposed to think about these kind of things.
Exactly. I mean,
because it's different. It's different in comics because I guess it's different in comics because everything's static, right? And
yes.
I don't, it doesn't seem odd or wrong at all to me. In fact, because of the layout, you're seeing one panel in relationship to the other panel all in a big grid. It never goes away. So there's also something about the symmetry of design that maybe argues for you doing something you never would do if you were going like, from one shot to another in a movie.
It's one of those rules. Like if it works, then you can do it.
Yeah.
If it doesn't work, don't do it. You know what I mean? It's that simple. Yeah. And like, you know, there is a certain level where you get where one gets, I assume, I'm not speaking from personal experience, but this is from looking at other artists that are like this level. There is a point where the royal rules don't matter to you anymore because you're just creating magic and it does flow, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
He almost never
hits a sour note.
Right.
Like, why did he do that? It's just, everything makes sense.
Yeah. Right. Whether or not you like the strip or find it funny or whatever, it's always impeccably crafted, you know?
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and I just wanted to bring up, I had mentioned that there were newspaper polls for popularity of comics.
Yeah.
Last time we got together and I promised I was going to try to look something up. It appears that became more of a thing starting, let's say, in the early 80s. Being the weird kid I was when I was in college, I learned that you could get a really cheap student subscription to Editor and Publisher magazine. And so I did. And sure. So it was like $12 for 52 issues of this thing. And basically, it was for editors and publishers of newspapers, but they had a syndicated section in every week's paper. There was something about syndicated columns or strips. And so I could keep up on the polls, what new strips were coming out, any controversies that were happening in comics. And it was, I loved it. It was great to read the thing. That's how I became familiar with these polls because if the Des Moines Register Tribune did a poll, they would send it in to editor and publisher and they would run it and they would show you how popular the strips were in any given town where the newspaper was. And I thought that was fascinating, but I guess I was in the sweet spot when I was subscribing to this, that it happened quite a bit. The whole thing, the whole archives are you can find on Internet Archive now, which is kind of cool. And I did find some polls. The earliest one I could get, there were two from 1983. So this is, we're 7 years ahead. And it's kind of fascinating to think what they would ask of the people who were reading would be different in different polls. And sometimes they'd ask multiple questions about the strips. One of them was, which strips do you like? And then the top of the poll was the highest percentage of people said they liked the strip. Then the other ones were, which do you read? Not whether they liked it or not. And then the other ones were like, which one are you most loyal to? And it's fascinating. Like sometimes they would have three different questions within a single poll. And the things shift based on those. You'd think it would all kind of be aligned. I like it. I read it. I'm loyal to it. But they actually shift. And it's fascinating. But the 1983 poll from the Lake County, Ohio News Herald had the top five strips by likes. The percentage of people who said they liked the strip. Peanuts was number one, 93% liked it. Number two was just behind it was High and Lois, 92% liked it. Number three, just behind that was Beetle Bailey with 90%. Oh. Number four was BC with 87%. And number five was Hagar the Horrible with 85%. And, you know, shout out to the Brown Walker crew that they got three of the top five. You know, these guys are masters of popular cartooning, but Peanuts was on top of that particular pile. And at the bottom, which always every once in a while, they will share the bottom ones. And at least one was mentioned.
The story strip.
Yeah. Brenda Starr was toward the bottom, but they say they have the most loyal readers. So, boy, if you drop a continuity strip, you are in big trouble. So that was always a difficulty. It's like, people don't like this, but the people that do like it, they're going to cancel their subscription. So the other 83 poll was from the Monroe Evening News. And this was interesting. This was in Michigan, and I'm guessing it's probably a suburb of Detroit. And so it could not run the papers, the strips that the newspapers in Detroit carried. So they have all of like the second and third tier strips. And so the number one is the Lockhorns. Number two is Beetle Bailey. Number three is Hagar. Number four is The Born Loser. And number five is Blondie. But they asked people, which strips would you like to add? And they were sorry to tell people that the top three choices were not available because of territorial rights. But the number one choices was Garfield. Second was Peanuts. Third was Family Circus, and fourth was For Better or For Worse, which they actually could get, so they did add it to the Monroe Evening News. So those are the 1983 choices. As we go along, I can share some other ones that are maybe more contemporary to the strips when we're reading these strips.
It's pretty wild, though, that Peanuts was 1983 that popular still. That's amazing.
Well, and that's the thing that they often would marvel over. There's one that's coming up that I'll talk about that Calvin and Hobbes had been in the Chicago Tribune for like less than a year, like 8 months. And it was the seventh most read strip. And it was number one for favorite and loyalty just in 8 months. So that just shows you the brilliance of Bill Watterson and how he upended the whole comic scene when he came along.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the loyalties, and there's another one I'll show where it's like going between those loyalties and things, seeing, you know, how red Peanuts is, but how much of a favorite is it? It's kind of sad as you think about it. It's like, I'll still read Peanuts because I love it, but I just don't like it as much as I used to. And so it doesn't do so well in the favorites and the loyalty because, you know, the strip, when it was in these later years, I think there was a general consensus that it wasn't as arresting and fresh as it had been before, but you know, they still loved it. They still love Schultz. They still love the characters, but they're kind of rooting for it. They're going to read it, but it's like, it's not my,
well, favorite. You know, yeah. Well, you know, we try to do it for 35 years, people, but it's like, and the thing that Watterson said about this, that he did not think Schultz fell behind. It's just that after 30 years, the industry caught up to him.
I think there's definitely truth to that. And I'm really going to be interested in the years to come. A lot of these, which I haven't read, these are kind of lost years for me with Peanuts, to see, you know, what are we finding in it? And once you take in a whole year at a time, you know, what, what is this strip? How does it feel?
Right. And that's my whole viewpoint of going forward with this stuff is I really like some of the odd corners and I want to find them and, you know, dust them off and show them to people who maybe, you know, maybe didn't give it as much a thought because like I'm sure I said this. I am of the opinion that if REM made 12 albums, they'd be considered the greatest American band of all time. There would be no question. Mm-hmm. They made 15 albums, right? That's the issue.
Yeah. Well, and I've said that about Laurel and Hardy, right? You know, they were picked up by studios that didn't give them the same way to make the films. And so they just basically had to recycle the stuff they had done all of their earlier years. But I'm so grateful for every single one of them.
Yep. And that's how I feel too.
And I feel like, and I read when I was looking for all these polls, I read this article, I can't remember, it was at the Boston Globe or, and I don't know if it was an opinion article in the newspaper or whatever. It didn't have a byline. And thank goodness, because this guy was basically saying, why did Peanuts go all the way to the end in 2000? He should have quit all this other time. And he specifically mentions Laurel and Hardy and saying how terrible it was that they had all these later works and pieces that weren't up to the snuff of what they had done before. They should have just thrown in the towel. I'm like, no.
And also it's their life.
Oh yes, their life, and they're better than 99.9% of other stuff, right. Even when they're redoing what they did in the past.
Exactly.
Yeah.
November 29th, Marcy and Peppermint Patty are in school taking a test. Peppermint Patty, on the sly, whispers to Marcy, "Hey, Marcy, what's the answer to the third question?" Marcy says, "Why should I tell you?" Peppermint Patty writes, "Number 3, why should I tell you?" And she says to Marcy, "Thanks, Marcy. We'll probably be the only ones in the whole class who'll get it right." Maybe Peppermint Patty just is stupid. That's okay.
Yeah,
she is sweetie.
It's certainly looking that way.
I'd like to see the teacher's reaction when they're reading that answer.
Be brilliant. It reminds me of Sally's classic, "I could not possibly care less." December 2nd, Linus and Charlie Brown are out for a winter stroll, and Linus says, "Today is my grandfather's birthday." Charlie Brown asks, "How old is he?" Linus says, 63. Then at the thinking wall, Linus says, "It's hard to believe that he was once a human being." That one always bugged me.
This one really hurts, I got to admit. How could you do this?
I know, and from Linus, no less.
Yeah.
I feel that this is a joke of someone who is getting older and a little self-conscious and puts it on the kid. I'll confess to something. I do this comic strip for Scout Life magazine, of all places. And I did a joke that was kind of like this in that it was sort of making fun of the position of the kid of not understanding something. And as soon as I sent it in, I knew I was getting it rejected because it's the opposite of what you need to be doing when you're specifically writing for kids. It has to be the kid's perspective. Mm-hmm. But I read this and that's how I feel. It's like, that's how Schultz is feeling. And then he puts it in the mouth of a kid, you know? Because I don't see that coming out of Linus's character.
Yeah, it's a little odd, but I will say it's well observed. It's a well observed little piece that, you know, people. I mean, you're older, you start to feel like you're in the shadows. People just don't see you. I mean, I remember as a little kid. I mean, when I was around older people, I didn't. It's strange. I didn't understand them. I didn't understand where they were coming from, how they saw the world, and. It's kind of like a little, well, it's interesting. As a kid, I don't know. I don't remember the strip, but I don't know if it would have felt a little bit of a knife in there myself as a little kid, because like, oh, I'm not, you know, I'm really not treating these people who are older than me the way I should be, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. December 9th, Charlie Brown is looking at something at the top of a snowy hill. And what he sees is Snoopy jetting by on, what are those kind of sleds called? The little round toboggan type things?
I thought this was a supper dish.
No, it's just a sled of some kind. They used to have these in the 70s and 80s. I had one. I can't remember what they're called. They're like saucers that you slide around on. Anyway, Snoopy zips by. Panel 3, Charlie Brown looks up to see what else is happening. And in panel 4, Woodstock zips by in his version, which is just his nest.
Big smile.
Very cute.
You always like to see Woodstock happy.
Yeah.
It is always good to see Woodstock happy, because that makes me happy. Hey, you know what else makes me happy? Getting to hang out here every week with you guys and talking peanuts and having our fantastic listeners out there listening. So this will bring us to the end of the year. We're going to get our MVPs and stuff later. But as we wrap this up, I just want to remind you, please go to our website, unpackingpeanuts.com, and you can sign up for our newsletter. If you want to send us an email, you could just send that to unpackingpeanuts@gmail.com. Find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Threads at Unpack Peanuts, and good old Facebook, we're Unpacking Peanuts. And if you're really ambitious, you could call the Peanuts hotline, and you could ask us a question or leave a comment, and you could even text that number. And that number is
717-219-4162.
So we would absolutely love to hear from you. But until next week, the only thing I need is Michael and Harold, give me your strip of the year and your MVP. Michael, why don't you go first?
Okay. Well, this is very superficial, but I'm going to go for strip of the year to the one strip that made me laugh out loud. So this is November 23rd, and it's the mustache on his head. It's just a great little sight gag.
Great piece of cartooning. Excellent pick. And who is your MVP?
Well, I didn't actually have one, but I think I did notice that Snoopy seemed to really carry the year.
Yeah.
He was, I don't know, if we're not counting appearances, but I think he definitely had more action than anybody this year. So I'll give it to him, but not my favorite year.
Harold, how about you?
Well, I'll just say, before you have to say yours, Jimmy, we can both have the same favorite if you want.
Go for it.
It's the May 9th Mother's Day strip with Snoopy and Woodstock. That thing is a little masterpiece. I love that strip. And it's so touching and poignant and funny at the same time. And as far as the favorite character for the most valuable peanut, I've kind of got a three-way thing going. I already gave it to Snoopy last year. I think he's pretty deserving this year too, like Michael was saying. And Woodstock is definitely really making a mark. But I think I'm going to give it to Marcy this year. Revealed some things about her character that are pretty fascinating. I loved the web of crime thing when Peppermint Patty is trying to get as many baseball caps as she can by scamming the baseball the stadium, and her response to the kid who likes her in camp. There's just a lot of interesting things going on with Marcy that are making me enjoy her character more and more.
All right. Well, those are great picks. Yeah. Obviously I love the Mother's Day one. I mean, I won't pick the same one because all right, here's what I'm going to do. I am going to agree with Michael and give Snoopy most valuable peanut. I do think he carried the year. I'm going to make a last minute change of strips though. And I'm going to go with April 11th because Pigpen came back after 9 years. And not only that, it has Patty and Violet. So there you go. So that's going to be my strip of the year. That's it, guys. So much fun. I loved reading these strips. I can't wait for 1977. And I hope you guys are here to listen to us talk all about it. Remember to be in touch between now and then on all those ways I told you. Until then, for Michael and Harold, this is Jimmy. Be of good cheer.
Yes.
Be of good cheer.
Unpacking Peanuts is copyright Jimmy Gownley, Michael Cohen, and Harold Buchholz. Produced and edited by Liz Sumner. Music by Michael Cohen. Additional voiceover by Aziza Shakrala Clark. For more from the show, follow Unpack Peanuts on Instagram and Twitter, Unpacking Peanuts on Facebook and YouTube. For more about Jimmy, Michael, and Harold, visit unpackingpeanuts.com. Have a wonderful day, and thanks for listening.
What is going on here?
Does your shoe have a boy inside? What a funny place for a boy to hide. Does your shoe have a dog there too? A boy and a dog and a foot in a shoe. Well, the boy is Buster Brown and the dog is Tige, his friend. And they're really just a picture, but it's fun to play pretend. So look, look, look in the telephone book for the store that sells the shoes with the picture of the boy and the dog inside so you can put your foot into Buster Brown's shoes. Arf, arf.